Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. What an extraordinary day. There's just so much going on. And on the, there's no way, of course, to do a newsletter or a website or a podcast without talking about what's happening today in the Senate. You know, you know that it's going to descend into farce and end in anticlimax, but it's opening with all of these rituals and the drama and the ceremonies. It's almost as if they're treating it like a serious historic moment, which, of course, they should be. But you have the articles of impeachment formally walked over to the upper chamber. They read the articles aloud. The chief justice is sworn in, and he administers his oath to all 100 senators that they have to be impartial, which, of course, they will completely ignore within 5 minutes. That's the over-under, actually, less than 5 minutes. So it does feel like they're going to take this seriously, which, of course, they should, as we got all this evidence of just this cloud of sleaze and corruption and frankly, just sheer stupidity surrounding what was going on in the Ukraine. And I was actually talking to a smart guy yesterday who said it's sort of like Veep meets The Sopranos. So, you know, we should start with Lev Parnas, who is, look, you know, take everything he says with a grain of salt. I'm skeptical about everybody, and there's reason to be skeptical about him given his shady past. But the guy actually has documents as well. And if I'm a United States senator, I have to be thinking, what else is coming down the pike? And just a reminder, I mean, A.B. Stoddard called this shot last month. She had a piece in The Bulwark saying, why is Mitch McConnell afraid of this man? And she pointed directly at Lev Parnas and said, this guy might know a lot of stuff. So keeping in mind that you always should be skeptical of a guy with his background, the stuff that he has dropped over the last 24 hours, I mean, the last 48 hours has been rather extraordinary. I mean, Greg Sargent wrote in the Washington Post, in a functional political environment, the explosive new documents from Lev Parnas just released by House investigators would rock the ongoing impeachment saga. They leave zero doubt that the scandal that got President Trump impeached will continue getting worse, and substantially so for him and his defenders. And then, of course, came that interview last night. Now, for the record, I thought it was a bad idea for him to go on television. I'm surprised his lawyers allowed him. But this is what he said. He essentially implicates everybody, but most specifically answers the question, or at least, you know, his version of what Donald Trump knew and when he knew it. This is what he said.
What do you think is the main inaccuracy or the main lie that's being told that you feel like you can correct?
That the president didn't know what was going on. President Trump knew exactly what was going on. He was aware of all of my movements. I wouldn't do anything without the consent of Rudy Giuliani or the president. I have no intent, I have no reason to speak to any of these officials. I mean, they have no reason to speak to me. Why would President Zelensky's inner circle or Minister Avakov or all these people or President Poroshenko meet with me? Who am I? Mm-hmm. They were told to meet with me, and that's the secret that they're trying to keep. I was on the ground doing their work.
Now, the other thing, of course, about Lev Parnas is everybody is saying that they don't know him. Nobody knows him. He's never around. And you can sort of understand this, even though he's got pictures of everybody. But listen to his discussion of all of his interactions with Trump and Rudy Giuliani.
In terms of the president and what he has said about you, he said about you and Mr. Fruman, Igor Fruman, I don't know those gentlemen, I don't know about them, I don't know what they do. You're saying that was not a true statement from the president?
He lied. I mean, we're not friends. I mean, when you say friends, I mean, me and him didn't watch football games together. We didn't eat hot dogs. But he knew exactly who we were. He knew exactly who I was, especially because I interacted with him at a lot of events. Mm-hmm. I had a lot of one-on-one conversations with him at gatherings where they would have special, like these round tables where there would be only six people at a table. We've had several of those. And basically, I mean, I was with Rudy more than, 4 or 5 days out of the week. I mean, and I was in constant contact with him. So, and I was with Rudy when he would speak to the president plenty of times.
Now, what's really striking is just how a guy like Lev Parnas and Hyde get so close to these main actors in all of this. And I think I mentioned on the podcast yesterday, it's this phenomenon of how they continually attract the worst people in the world. It is sort of like this magnet that here's a guy who, frankly, I think, you know, anybody with a radar, an ethical radar, would say, you don't want to be near this guy. And he's everywhere. He's sort of like Zelig. And he and Rudy Giuliani, I think the evidence would suggest, were joined at the hip. So this thing just gets more and more bizarre. And speaking of bizarre, we have a couple of developments this morning. Ukraine has announced, the Interior Ministry has announced a criminal investigation into the alleged illegal surveillance of former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, after these text messages that were released showing that Robert Hyde and Lev Parnas apparently discussed her being tracked. Whether that was drunken or not, we don't know. And it is kind of remarkable that Ukraine responds with an announcement of investigation while the State Department remains silent. But I suppose, you know, Donald Trump wanted his Ukrainian investigation and he gets it. And then, because we just can't, you know, have a slow news day, the Government Accountability Board said this morning the Trump administration did, in fact, break the law when it withheld U.S. security aid to Ukraine. It says, the GAO says, that the White House violated the Impoundment Control Act, which says funds appropriated by Congress cannot be withheld by the White House. So, again, on Earth 2.0, that would be a very, very big deal because it answers the question about whether or not Trump was completely justified in withholding the aid. So joining us today, because there's also this election going on and we are less than 3 weeks away from the Iowa caucuses, so we are joined by our former colleague David Beiler, who is now a data... Now, what is your title? You're like a data guru at the Washington Post now.
Right? Yeah, my title is data analyst and political columnist. So I, you know, do math about elections, make things on the internet, write stuff. It's a fun gig.
So you're into math, huh? This is a math. There's math.
Yeah, yeah. That's kind of my thing for yeah. All my work stuff. I try to have data in it, or else, you know, use kind of empirical modes of thinking. Try to think through testable stuff. Think about what we can't know, as well as what we can know, that sort of style of thing.
So this distinguishes you from other pundits who just pull everything out of their you-know-what. pretend to know stuff. Okay, so speaking of math, you know who I met yesterday? I ran into Andrew Ooh. Yang, of all people.
Oh, no way.
And, you know, he has a little lapel pin, math, on it. Just random. And I've never met him before, and I will be honest. Let me confess right now, for all you Yang Gang people out there, that I frankly haven't been paying that much attention, because, you know, attention is a finite resource, and I just haven't. But I found him rather engaging. Somebody came up to him and said, when we were standing there, somebody came up to him and said, "So Andrew, what did you think of the debate last night?" And without cracking a smile, he just said, "Well, I felt that something was missing." So it was pretty good. Okay, so David, I want to talk about Iowa and what you are seeing. But before we do that, there is this moment we're at right now, and I want to talk about how the Democrats are going to, you know, react to all of this. Democrats keep saying that they think that Donald Trump is an existential threat, but and Tim Miller has made the point, but they're not acting like it. So here on the day in which the impeachment trial formally begins, in which we have one bombshell after another being dropped, the big story out of the Democratic primary continues to be this Elizabeth Warren Bernie Sanders spat. And I thought it was going to be a one-day story because it would be blown out by impeachment. But amazingly, it has continued. It is now a day two story, in part because there was an open mic, and everybody remembers this story. So it's after the debate, and Elizabeth Warren goes over to Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders tries to shake her hand. She very clearly does not shake his hand. And then they have what looks like a rather tense, you know, conversation that breaks off. Well, CNN last night said, amazingly, they went through their audio, and they actually have an audio of what was said. And here it is.
A liar on national TV?
What?
I think you called me a liar on national TV.
Let's not do it right now. You want to have that discussion? We'll have that discussion. You called me. You told me. All right, let's not do it now.
I don't want to get in the middle, but I just want to say hi, Bernie.
Yeah, good. Okay.
Okay. Ouch. So, David, I know you're the data guy, but what do you make of the fact that the two most progressive candidates are going at it like this? And this thing is not de-escalating. I mean, that was not an edifying exchange. So given the incredibly fluid state of Iowa, what do you think is going on, or how will this play? Does anyone know?
Well, I'm not sure anyone knows exactly how it'll play, but the fact that there's some conflict between, you know, Sanders and Warren makes all the sense in the world. What you have right now in Iowa is basically a four-car pileup between Joe Biden, Pete Buttigieg, Elizabeth Warren, and Bernie Sanders. You have people running very tightly with each other. There's, you know, a new Monmouth poll, a new Seltzer poll, and each of these polls basically show that everyone is within striking distance of each other. Now, if you're Elizabeth Warren or you're Bernie Sanders, you're there thinking, okay, where are my votes going to come from? And the most obvious answer is each other. You have both of them as sort of fellow travelers in the progressive world. They're both beloved by, you know, the left broadly. And they're thinking, okay, if I'm going to get a leg up and make sure that Joe Biden or Pete Buttigieg doesn't get the nomination and that I do, they're going to have to go for each other. There's also a little bit of an interesting dynamic. I'm wondering why Sanders isn't attacking Joe Biden. He has potentially a route in there as well, because they share some amount of blue collar support. But yeah, you know, if you had told me months ago, okay, less than 3 weeks from Iowa, this is what the polling looks like, I think it would have been pretty safe to predict, oh yeah, something is going to happen and there's going to be real tension between Sanders and Warren, who seem, you know, according to the reporting prior to this, to be, you know, relatively friendly with each other.
Yeah, I may be the only one who remembers when the non-aggression pact between Donald Trump and Ted Cruz ended very, very badly. They weren't going to say anything bad about one another, and where it got. I mean, it's pretty clear that, to me, that Elizabeth Warren is the one that fired the shot here. That her folks initially planted the story, Sanders folks pushed back on it, then she had an on-the-record confirmation. And, you know, look, Elizabeth Warren's a very, very smart and savvy woman, okay? It's just, you know, and is sophisticated in the ways of the media. To go over and have that confrontation with mics on, knowing that the cameras were there, that had to be a decision on her part. You know, everybody in media and politics knows that when you have a microphone around you, you assume that it's on. So she had to know, you know, even though during the debate that she was de-escalating, that she didn't want to get into a fight, but she had to know that this was going to be a thing. And so it's a very aggressive move on her part, and she clearly is going at him. Now, the key number here, besides, I need to get a little bit wonky with you, because, of course, that's what you do, but is the 15% threshold in Iowa. I mean, this is crucial. You drop below 15%, and you, well, explain how that works and how this plays into it, because I don't think you can understand exactly the strategies and the tactics of the candidates without understanding how crucial that 15% threshold is in the Iowa caucus.
Yeah, so this is definitely a wonky topic. Essentially, what happens in Iowa is you have people who go to their different caucus sites on caucus night. They go in with their, you know, favorite candidate, thinking, "Oh, I'm a, you know, Sanders supporter or a Warren supporter or a Biden supporter or whatever," and they all go, and you have kind of a first round of voting, but if your candidate doesn't get to 15%, then your candidate becomes non-viable at that caucus site, and the supporters of that candidate get to sort of reallocate to whomever. So if Elizabeth Warren,
so this is why the second choice, this is why the second choice numbers are so crucial in a place like Iowa.
Bingo.
Okay. Right.
Yeah, it's why the second choice numbers are so crucial in a place like Iowa. It's why sort of the lanes that have been, you know, kind of poo-pooed in some circles, why the lanes actually are important, is because, you know, in Iowa, you have the second choices mattering. So if you're Elizabeth Warren, say you lose a couple more points, you start looking like you're going to be under the threshold at various places, your overall vote share in terms of, you know, the traditional delegate estimates that are reported every night or every 4 years, your overall vote share could drop. You know, if you're at, say, 10% everywhere, you're not going to get, you know, 10% of the delegates because your people are going to get reallocated to others. Now, Iowa, there is one other little wrinkle that makes it even more of a mess, which is that the Democrats are releasing three different vote totals, including first choice, including, you know, choices after some of these reallocation steps. But the point is that if you're Elizabeth Warren, what you're looking at right now is being slightly behind the other sort of three leading candidates in Iowa. You're looking for a way to vault yourself forward. You probably think that you're a better sort of consensus candidate than Bernie Sanders. You know, she's someone who has an ability to sort of expand her support a little bit more than Sanders, but her base seems a little bit less loyal. And so, yeah, of course, we're seeing Warren target Sanders right now because she's thinking, okay, I gotta, you know, make some last minute moves, do the last minute surge that so many other candidates have. And that's how I stay in this game.
Yeah. So, and she needs to get the, she needs to get some votes from these leaders, because it doesn't really help her if she gets, if she's the second choice of some of the other folks who will also not make the threshold.
Right.
So tell me about, you wrote a piece a couple of days ago that you thought that Amy Klobuchar was the big wild card in Iowa. It's interesting because there's so many dueling commentaries out there that, you know, that she's disappointed. This is her last stand versus that this is, you know, she's poised to actually move, but she's also potentially a victim of this 15% threshold. So give me your sense of why you think Amy Klobuchar is a wild card.
Yeah. So I sort of discovered this while working with some math that I built for the simulator over at the Washington Post, which, by the way, listeners should check out. I've got a new simulator up where you can sort of play out your own Iowa caucus scenarios. It runs a model for you. Anyways, point is,
by the way, which is just so awesome. I mean,
thank you.
Because you do need to play this game to understand how complicated this is. This is not just, and I hope people are getting this notion that when people show up at the caucus, they may end up voting for somebody completely different than their first choice candidate walking in the door, which is why there are so many different possible scenarios. So I'm sorry, I just wanted to help you give a plug there, David, to the simulator.
I appreciate it. I appreciate the plug. It's always welcome. But yeah, what happens according to the simulator is it looks at, you know, candidates in the past who have been at about 7% this far out from election day. And it kind of creates a spread of plausible results for them. And what you see for Amy Klobuchar is that there is a possibility of a surge right at the tail. Basically, if everything goes right for her, you know, if she kind of, you know, makes the right moves, hits a lot of lucky breaks, her, you know, opponents stumble, she's the sort of candidate who could go from 7% up to 15% or 20%, or be kind of the surprise of the night. That is not such a plausible outcome for candidates who are at, you know, 0%. Candidates who are at 0% typically just stay at zero, but candidates who have a small following, historically speaking, like Klobuchar, have that boom potential. But these rules that we were talking about in the caucus system are also a threat to Klobuchar, because if she doesn't sort of get over that threshold and get to the point where her people are, you know, viable at their different caucus sites, then the election night results might be kind of brutal. If you're someone who's stuck at 8 to 10% of the vote going in, you're going to get a lot less of the delegates. And with Klobuchar, it seems like everything is in on Iowa. That seems like her plan. And if she booms there, she could really, you know, make some noise, be sort of the story coming out of the night. But she has a lot of bust potential too. And that puts her between the two tiers. You know, you expect the people in the top four in Iowa to do really pretty well on caucus night. You expect Klobuchar to potentially have a boom and bust. And you really don't expect much out of anyone else, I would say.
Yeah, if any of the top four, and we're talking about Biden and Bernie and Elizabeth and Buttigieg, if any of those four don't make the top four, that's going to be a big story, and that's going to be a huge blow for them.
Oh yeah,
I mean there's no question about it. So with Elizabeth Warren and Bernie going at one another, it's hard not to see that as a sort of a win for Joe Biden, who's just sort of sitting there and he's not part of it, but also. And here's something we've never encountered before, that a few days before this caucus, the senators, Bernie, Elizabeth, there's so many candidates, I'm going to forget one, but Klobuchar, three of the U.S. senators are not going to be able to be in Iowa, where retail politics is so crucial. They're going to have to be in the United States Senate. This also is, obviously a huge advantage for people like Biden and Buttigieg, who will be able to be there on the ground. And notoriously, Iowa and New Hampshire voters want that sort of one-on-one. So do you have any sense of how that changes the dynamic at all?
It feels like we've been in a 4 or 5 year stint of constant perfect storm of news, right? Yeah, it's an interesting thing, because one undercounted, undervalued possibility in this primary is a Biden win in Iowa, and he just kind of rolls. If you have Biden and Buttigieg there, sort of in the last leading days into the caucus, being there, shaking hands, kissing babies, the whole bit, that's helpful. Being in the place works, and Biden. People write him off because there are a lot of sort of white, more progressive voters in Iowa and in New Hampshire. It's the sort of state that tends to favor a Sanders or a Warren type candidacy. But if Sanders and Warren are fracturing, each other's bases, there's potentially enough room for Biden to slip through. This is a highly unsettled primary. It's very different than 2016 on the Democratic side, where there was this interesting ideological fight, but everybody knew how it was going to turn out. On this end, there's a lot of different interesting fights, and nobody knows how it's going to turn out.
Okay, so let's just step back for a moment, because, of course, we obsess about all of these things. I mean, clearly talk about perfect storm. Impeachment is going to suck up all the oxygen now for a couple of weeks, but Iowa, gets a lot of attention. So is Iowa still as important as it has been in the past? So, I mean, there is this conventional wisdom that if one candidate wins both Iowa and New Hampshire, that they, in effect, become unstoppable. Is that still true?
Yeah. So you can kind of break the question down in a couple ways that I think is helpful. I think all of our elections are a little bit more nationalized than they used to be. I tend to think that makes Iowa a little bit less important than it has been in the past. That being said, Iowa's always going to be important when you have a field this gigantic and this fractured and this, messy and insane. It's going to winnow out a number of candidates who just don't make the cut and are hanging on right now. It's going to, if Buttigieg or Warren doesn't perform well in Iowa, I think that's going to be pretty bad news for their campaign, because, Sanders can still cross his fingers and bet on Nevada mm-hmm. if the first ones don't go well for him. Biden's whole strategy is to cross his fingers and bet on South Carolina. So I think that it still is important this cycle, just because of the insanity of it. But, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party have both changed demographically over the years, and Iowa and New Hampshire are just they're representative of one block of the party,
right?
But they're not representative of the whole party. And so I think that it's hard, but I think in theory, you could imagine Joe Biden, as long as he places reasonably well, losing Iowa, losing New Hampshire, and kind of dragging it out until he gets some wins in possibly Nevada or South Carolina, and then making the case on Super Tuesday. But Biden, I think, is hoping for just some clean, good news out of those first two states and to try to wrap this thing up relatively early. But, this thing's a mess, Charlie. Like, we can talk through a thousand different scenarios that are all equally likely for it. It's not it's not a primary that's as easy to analyze as 2016 on the Democratic side. And just from a pure horse race perspective, I would say it's also a little bit more complicated than 2016 on the Republican side. But, you know, there were a lot of non-horse race aspects about that one that were crazy. Yeah.
So what are the possibilities? Of course, you know that I'm sitting here in Wisconsin, a few miles north of Milwaukee. What are the prospects that the Democrats will come to Milwaukee without having a nominee? I mean, an open convention in Milwaukee, in the heartland.
Yeah. So I'd split this up into sort of a couple different questions. I would say there is a real chance that by the time, you know, June is here and we've had the last, you know, primaries and caucus and we watched all the, you know, everything happen, that nobody has a majority of delegates. That is totally, totally plausible. The interesting thing, and it's also plausible that, like, you know, technically on the first vote, you know, no one has a majority and then the superdelegates swoop in. I've become a little bit more bearish on convention drama, partially because there are real lanes that you can see within the top four that if they really did, you know, split up the delegates in some sort of way that kept one person from having a majority, you really could imagine people joining up and joining together. I mean, if Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are looking at, you know, the prospect of a Joe Biden nomination, but they together have 50% of the delegates, you really could imagine them putting down their differences and just picking one of the two. Same sort of goes for Joe Biden and Pete Buttigieg. Buttigieg has, you know, shown that he is trying to be a little bit more in the sort of moderate technocrat, I guess you could call it, lane of the party, trying to be not as extreme as Warren or Sanders, but still maybe have some cultural affinity with Warren voters. And you could imagine him saying, okay, you know, the best thing for my ideology, and frankly, for his own political career, would be to throw his people to Biden and make that happen. So there's commonality there that I think might break up a logjam.
Well, but there's another phenomenon as well, that whoever goes in with the most delegates has got to be considered the favorite, because it's hard for me to imagine that if Bernie Sanders comes in and he's number one with the delegates, that he's not going to walk out with a nomination. Same thing with Joe Biden.
Yeah.
I think there's going to be tremendous pressure to get behind who's ever in first place, even if they don't have a majority. Now, speaking of Bernie voters, you know, it's just a fascinating phenomenon for me to watch the Bernie bros online. And, you know, distinguishing, you know, that Bernie's not responsible for everything that his bros are doing online.
Sure.
But the level of vitriol, the level of, you know, absolutism, it does, I will say, that reminds me a lot of some of the Trump online support out there. Have you ever broken down the numbers about the number of, going back to 2016, the number of Bernie Sanders primary supporters who did not get behind Hillary Clinton? I think I saw an analysis recently, or breakdown, that if you look at the number of Bernie Sanders supporters who did not support Clinton, or who even switched over to vote for Donald Trump, that actually provides the margin of victory for Trump in the swing states. So a lot of the Bernie supporters are really in play in the general election too, depending on how this plays out. True?
Yeah, so it's an interesting thing. One analysis I saw estimated that about a quarter of Bernie Sanders' supporters in the 2016 Democratic primary were kind of never Clinton voters. You could have them. I think this was a 538 one. I forget. I'd have to double check. But that about a quarter of his supporters were people who didn't vote or voted for Trump or voted third party and just, you know, said straight no to Hillary Clinton. And you can see there's a significant segment of the Democratic Party that's just Bernie or bust. No matter what happens to him, no matter, you know, what's going on, if he, you know, has a heart attack, has a bad debate performance, you know, gets into a feud with Elizabeth Warren, he just almost always stays within 15 or 20% in the national polls. That's his, like, band. And the interesting thing, I'm going to scoot myself a little bit because I've got something on this that I'm working on now, is that Bernie Sanders has that 15 or 20% core support, but the sort of vitriol the establishment has for Bernie Sanders doesn't really translate to the rank and file. His favorability ratings among Democratic primary voters are just pretty good across the board. The percentage in the most recent YouGov poll of Democrats who would be disappointed if he won the nomination, that disappointed percentage was actually lower for Bernie Sanders than it was for Joe Biden. You know, if we're talking through a situation like the one you described, where Bernie Sanders comes out with a plurality of deaths, he has Democratic legitimacy, and there's a chance that the voters just, you know, say, okay, this is our guy, this is the person, and then we'll have, you know, a couple really wild primaries in a row, one where, you know, Donald Trump gets nominated, and one where, you know, the Democratic Party nominates a Democratic Socialist, which would be, you know, quite a roller coaster.
It would be quite a roller coaster and kind of a nightmare for anybody who is a centrist in the country right now. A lot of reports that the Trump people are really now, you know, thinking that Bernie Sanders is the perfect candidate to run against, which, of course, you know, I mean, remembering 2016 that the Democrats thought that Trump was the perfect candidate to run against. But the Republicans do seem to relish running against Bernie Sanders. I wonder whether or not Bernie Sanders has benefited from some of the restraint that Trump benefited from in 2016. Remember, in 2016, a lot of other Republicans just assumed he would fall apart, so they did not attack him. They did not go after him until it was too late. And I wonder whether or not there's been the same phenomenon, because there hasn't been, with the exception of this latest spat with Elizabeth Warren, there hasn't been a lot of Democratic scrutiny of Bernie Sanders, maybe because he's been around for a long time. But, you know, once you go into a general election, Bernie Sanders has got a lot of baggage. I mean, it's hard for me to imagine any other guy his age who had a heart attack going into this campaign. Hard for me to imagine anybody else with the kind of extreme past that he has, including, you know, and I'm sorry for the Bernie bros out there, you know, honeymooning in the Soviet Union, aligning himself with pretty extreme positions on foreign policy, supporting vast expansions of government spending, huge tax increases. This strikes me as that have Democrats fully gamed out how that plays in a general election in swing states?
This is a really great question. I would say that dynamic you're describing where, you know, Sanders gets less scrutiny, and I think both Biden and Sanders have benefited from that. People just assumed that they would fall apart, and Sanders has held on to his base and has at least a path through the chaos, and Biden has really held on to his base and seems like, you know, the front runner. But yeah, the interesting thing, so Gallup does this survey every so often where it lists off a bunch of different categories of candidates. It lists off, you know, okay, candidates who's African-American, a woman, a man, an evangelical Christian, someone who's LGBT, and they have all these different categories, and they ask voters, would you feel comfortable voting for someone from your party who was fill in the blank? And at the bottom of the list in their 2019 survey was socialist. That was worse than any other category that they tested. So, you know, if Bernie Sanders does get the nomination, you give Donald Trump sort of a pretty fruitful line of attack that says this person is a socialist. Now, you know, I'll admit my youngness. I was born in 91, so I don't have a, you know, personal memory of the Cold War, but a lot of voters do have a very personal memory of the Cold War and of the USSR and the United States sort of struggle there. And it, you know, sort of sets the hackles up for a lot of voters before they even think about, you know, anything else about the candidate. So it's, you know, it's definitely a liability. I guess the thing that I would argue, though, is that Sanders has a hidden advantage, which is that he can sort of run against Trump on populism. Part of Trump's ability to win on 2016 was that he was, you know, kind of flimsy on the economic stuff, realized that libertarian economics, whatever you think the merits are, good or bad, kind of doesn't pull great and he sort of combines that with the cultural stuff. Bernie Sanders has some ability to do the authentic economic populism as well in sort of a way that could match Trump in an interesting way. So I think that Bernie Sanders, he's a little bit of a wild card, but there's definitely liabilities that I think people haven't priced in because they just assumed he'd bump along at
right.
15 or 20%. And he still might do that, but he really could win the nomination. This is a live possibility.
It is very much a live possibility. And just an example of this, to go back to the health issue, because I remember how Hillary Clinton's alleged health problems were weaponized in 2016. I mean, she was virtually on death's door if you listen to a lot of conservative media back in 2016. That was a big, 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 big issue. I'm trying to imagine what the debate would be, the political situation would be, if it had been Joe Biden who had suffered a heart attack a few months ago. Could Joe Biden have survived that? There's no way. Or if Donald Trump had suffered a heart attack, or any other candidate. So it is this weird little zone that I think you've described very, very well, that Bernie Sanders finds himself in, that he's able to skate on things that other candidates haven't been. But I wonder whether there's an expiration date on all of this.
Mm.
Which would,
yeah,
would
it's
be.
A good question.
Yeah, I mean,
it's a good question.
I put myself in a you know, strong, highly, highly skeptical of Sanders' electability in a general election. And I'm sitting here in Wisconsin. By the way, you've seen the numbers out of Wisconsin from the Marquette University law poll yesterday showing how close mm-hmm. everything is here in Wisconsin. This is the most respected poll, with Joe Biden leading Donald Trump by 4 points, 49-45. Bernie Sanders up by one, at least now. Elizabeth Warren, though, would lose to Donald Trump by 3 points, 48-45. And Pete Buttigieg is 4 points behind, 46-44. Obviously, that's all within the margin of error. But it shows that Wisconsin is going to be, once again, incredibly close. And at least for the moment, this poll would reinforce Joe Biden's strongest argument that he's the most electable.
Yeah, I mean, there's a good argument to be made that Wisconsin is one of the most likely tipping point states, which means that, you know, the candidate who wins Wisconsin, you know, gets those electoral votes. That might be their 270th mm-hmm. vote, and maybe everything else they win is icing on the cake. But that was the one they kind of needed to get there in the past. So yeah, and it does reinforce Biden's strongest argument. I mean, this whole time the Biden campaign has had two real advantages. One is this, you know, raft of polls that consistently comes out showing him performing better against Donald Trump than his opponents. I think people internalize that both from their own reading and from the media. I think people sort of get that that's a thing. And the other advantage is his association with Barack Obama. I mean, if Joe Biden had just been a senator from Delaware for, you know, 8 more years and had never been vice president to Obama, I think that he would just be another guy running for president and wouldn't really make a dent, which is actually what happened in 1988 and 2008. But yeah, I think that this is part of the Biden advantage. I mean, Charlie, you know, you're living in Wisconsin. I think probably every time you turn on the TV, it's going to be a political ad starting in about June, going through all the way through November. It's going to be one of the hotly contested states.
Oh, no question about it. Okay, one last question here. Speaking of Joe Biden, because the real rock solid case for Joe Biden starts with the overwhelming lead he has among African Americans. And how mm-hmm. crucial that is. And of course, a lot of that reflects his association with Barack Obama, but also the sense that he is the strongest candidate to beat Donald Trump. So the non-Biden scenario would be that if he, you know, stumbles early on, that African-American support begins to soften for him. They begin to give a second look to other candidates, and he begins to evaporate. But what is your sense? I am really struck by how durable his support is among African Americans. I mean, not only is it wide, but it seems to be pretty solid. I mean, I don't follow the polls as closely as you do, but I just don't see any erosion there.
Yeah, so there's two sort of facts that I think are helpful here. One is also in the Washington Post, Ted Johnson He basically made the argument that you can look at the history of African-American voting in Democratic primaries and basically see just a strain of pragmatism. And that sort of your key to understanding why Biden's support is so durable is that a lot of Black voters essentially have beating Trump as their priority number one. They see Biden as the candidate who is most able to do that. You know, association with Barack Obama, frankly, gives you credit across the entire Democratic Party. And so, you know, there you go. That's a recipe for durability. So I think that's one big thing. One interesting thing that you also see is the age gradient among African-American voters, but among a number of different voters of, you know, all different races. You see an age gradient where Biden is doing really, really well with older Black voters, but younger Black voters are interested in Bernie Sanders, and that he kind of has this youth thing going. You get a little bit less bang for your buck with the youth vote just because people who are, you know, in their 20s and 30s don't turn out as much as people in their 60s. But at the same time, Sanders, you know, back in 2016 just posted such incredible margins with young voters. That's kind of one wrinkle that I've seen in the whole landscape in states like South Carolina, where Biden's trying to put up his firewall.
David Byler, thanks so much for coming back on the Bulwark Podcast and spending so much time with us. Appreciate it very, very much. And of course, you also have a daily news. You have a newsletter. Is it a daily newsletter?
Yeah. So it's a weekly newsletter. Called The Odds. You go, you know, sign up for it over at the Washington Post. Yeah. And that'll have my work, the work of my colleagues in the opinion section. It'll have analysis that's just in the newsletter. So yeah, that's another one of the things along with the simulator that's going on for the primary. And yeah, thanks so much for having me. This is fun.
Well, I appreciate it very, very much. And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow and we'll do this all over again.